Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 17, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, our inaugural installment of our new series of telephone conference calls, the Classic Law Review Articles Revisited series. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to welcome to today's call four experts. Our call is going to be led by our returning moderator, James A. Haynes. He's an attorney and alternate judge at the U.S. Department of Labor Employees Compensation Appeals Board. He's also a good friend of the Federalist Society and a longtime leader among its practice groups. He's going to introduce our panel this afternoon and then have the run of show. With that, Mr. Haynes, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Good afternoon. We're very happy, I'm very happy, to be able to introduce a panel that is going to talk about a law review article that was first published in February of 1949 by the Harvard Law Review. It is a matter of distinction, if only because it is the only law review article that many of us are aware of that has no footnotes. We can note it for that, but we can also note it for many other ways in which it teaches and in which it has endured as a sort of item of interest, I think, in the mental furniture of a lot of attorneys and a lot of people who are interested in the law and the process by which judges make their decisions. Our panel this afternoon is drawn from many time zones, I guess beginning with the furthest away. Professor James Allen is the Garrick Professor of Law at the University of Queensland, Australia, and he teaches at the T.C. Byrne School of Law. Our other panelists are Professor Dan Priel of Osgoode Hall School of Law, York University, Toronto, Canada. And finally, Professor Fred Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law, University of Virginia Law School down the road in Charlottesville. The makeup of our panel suggests that really not only has this article traveled, but it has also been a teaching tool not only in the United States, but in all of the countries that recognize a sort of a common law heritage of jurisprudence. So the article that we will be discussing is taught in Australia, taught in Canada, as well as here in the United States. And our panel reflects that, as well as the differing views from those different places. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Jim Allen to tell us a little bit about the article and what it says and why it has no footnotes.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, Dean. If anyone's wondering why I sound like a Canadian down in Australia, I am a Canadian, but I've lived in Australia for quite a while. My kids have the right accent down here. So Jim is correct that this article is widely taught. I've taught it not just in Australia, but New Zealand and Hong Kong. And I just think it's a tremendous introduction to a jurisprudence course. In fact, that's what Filler wrote it for. He wrote it for his class at Harvard, as Jim said, back in 1949. And my job to start the talk this afternoon is to just set out a bit of the facts. There's no footnotes because effectively the article is a 16-page hypothetical judgment. And what Filler does is he sets this in the future, in the year 4300, in a jurisdiction he calls Newgarth. And he sets it up so that we're going to get five different opinions, judgments. And the facts of the case you need to know if you haven't already read the Spelunking Explorers. So spelunkers are cave explorers. And five cave explorers go off for a fun day, and there's a landslide, and they get trapped inside. And what happens next, which is recounted in the judgment of the Chief Justice, is that in the course of trying to rescue these five, 10 people die. 10 rescuers die. on the 20th day of being trapped, they've run out of supplies, but they do have a radio, so they radio to the outside world, and the five men ask if there's any way that they're going to be rescued shortly. They don't get a positive answer to that. They then ask for some advice about what would happen if one of them were killed and eaten by the other four. They get no advice on that. The radio goes dead. On the 32nd day, the rescuers break through, and four of the men are still alive. One is dead, and it transpires that the five men set out a way to decide who would be killed, and they rolled dice. Now, Fuller does this for a reason, because there are several real-life cases. In the UK, in the non-American common law world, it's Dudley and Stevens, which was an 1840s case of a shipwreck, and what happened in that case and all similar cases is that the cabin boy gets killed. There's no procedural fairness. The big guys eat the little guy. There's also an American case, U.S. v. Holmes, which was from the 1840s, somewhat similar, except that the crew basically threw the passengers overboard. Fuller wants to avoid all the procedural unfairness claims. He wants to make you focus on the substance. And the students don't like this because they're trying to look for an easy way out. But effectively, you cannot complain about how the victim, if you want to call them victim, is chosen. So they roll dice. There's no fixed dice. Fuller makes it plain that if you don't pick one person to be killed and eaten, all five will die. So there's no easy way out on that front either. And then you get to the trial where the jury refuses to give a verdict. In effect, the jury gives the facts and says, well, if these facts amount to guilty, that's fine. And it gets appealed up to the top court in Newgarth. And what you get is a sort of a tour de force by Fuller of setting out different ways to approach the problem, which Fred's going to talk about. Let me just say before I finish off with the introduction that Fuller engineers it so that all five of the judges implicitly accept that what was done was morally acceptable. They then proceed to differ on what that the effect of that when the law points the other way. And I think the listeners will notice that in a lot of cases that get to a top court, in fact, the judges don't just disagree on the law. Take same-sex marriage, take euthanasia, take abortion. They also disagree on whether this is the morally acceptable thing to do, but not in the Spelunking Explorers. Even the judges who want to convict these men implicitly think that what they did under the circumstances was morally acceptable. And so that's quite a coup the way Fuller does it. And the other thing I'll say before I hand over to Fred is every year I poll my students and I ask them, what position do you think the writer, Fuller, actually held himself? And it's next to impossible, if you haven't read other things by Fuller, to get that right. I mean, it's very, very difficult. So Fuller is incredibly adept at giving the points of view that he doesn't agree with a powerful, forceful case. So I think that's an introduction to the case. If I've left out anything, Fred and Dan can jump in.
Very good. We'll move to Professor Schauer to talk further about the article.
Okay.
Thank you for your introduction.
Thank you. Fred Schauer here. My first exposure to this came in the fall of 1969 when I had Lon Fuller for a jurisprudence course at the Harvard Law School. I have since written about the article, and when I teach jurisprudence now, decades and decades after I took it from Fuller, I teach this article and ask my students, with a little bit of a procedural twist, to write their own opinion about it. But that's beside the point. As Jim Allen said, one of the great things about the article is that it presents a more or less sympathetic treatment of a number of different ways of dealing with the central problem, which is that the letter of the law clearly points in one direction and morality pretty clearly points in another direction. We can argue about the letter of the law, we can argue about the moral issues, but it is certainly a common situation where the letter of the law and morality point in different directions, lead to different outcomes, and that's what Fuller wants us to struggle with. So Chief Justice Truepenny, in his opinion, acknowledges that the letter of the law requires conviction, and then goes on to say, because the letter of the law requires conviction, and because we are judges, and as judges we are required to follow the letter of the law, we should vote to convict. But, and then says, there are other people in the system who have different responsibilities from judges. The governor can, after all, give a pardon or clemency or something of that variety. So Justice Truepenny says, we should convict, but at the same time, we should urge the governor to commute the sentence of death, urge the governor to pardon or in some other form grant clemency. Then the first response comes from Justice Foster. Those of us who are familiar with Fuller's work are pretty clear that Justice Foster is, in fact, Fuller, or Justice Foster's views are closest to Fuller's. And Justice Foster says that it is important that we distinguish the law from the letter of the law. And some might call this natural law, some might call it something else. But Justice Foster says the law, broadly understood, is not only the letter of the law, but it also includes moral considerations. And importantly, it also includes the fundamental idea of reasonableness. That which is within the letter of the law but unreasonable is not law for that very reason. And therefore, Justice Foster says, regardless of what the letter of the law may say, these people have not violated the law, capital L, we can call it, and therefore they should be acquitted. It's a expansive notion of what the law is. Some associate it with the natural law tradition. More recently, some associate it with the views of the recently deceased legal theorist Ronald Dworkin, which understands law to include a whole range of moral and other kinds of considerations, as well as just what the letter of the law says. Then there's Justice Tatting. Justice Tatting, to use the language of the current day punts. That is, Justice Tatting says, yes, I recognize that this is a really, really hard problem. I'm not comfortable with what Justice Foster does. I think the letter of the law leads us in one direction. But then he says, but I'm not sure about this. And he goes back and forth for some number of pages and says, then I must withdraw. And he refuses to vote. And one of the things that Fuller asks us to think about is, under these circumstances, is withdrawing really withdrawing? That is, given that, as I'll say in a moment, given that the other justices come out 2-2, the result of Justice Tatting's withdrawing is, in effect, to uphold the death penalty for these people. Is that really withdrawing if you know the consequences of your withdrawal? Then we have Justice Keene. Justice Keene has a very straightforward, this is what the letter of the law says, therefore they are guilty. That's my vote. It's none of our business what the governor does. It would be wrong for us to urge clemency or do anything else. We all have different roles. Our role is to follow the law. The law is consistent with the letter of the law, and therefore I vote to convict, period. Finally, there's Justice Handy, somewhat close to what we might now think and what Fuller certainly thought in 1949 was the legal realist position. That is, what judges should do is partly take account of the letter of the law, but also take account of a whole lot of other things, including public opinion, maybe including personal knowledge. After all, Justice Handy says he's heard about what the governor might do, from his wife's housekeeper, and he takes that into consideration. He takes common sense into consideration. I call it a legal realist position in part because the most prominent legal realists, people like Jerome Frank and less overtly Carl Llewellyn and others, said this is in fact what judges do. And we should be straightforward about it. Judges are human beings. They take into account the things that everyone else would take into account. And Justice Handy is just making it explicit. So let me just say in conclusion of this introductory thing that echoing what Jim Allen said, the beauty of this is that Fuller makes clear that all of these are sociologically acceptable positions. None of these judges in 1949 United States or in 2015 United States would get fired or even widely criticized for this. These are all on the wall rather than off the wall moves. We can and should debate normatively which of these approaches is good and bad, but Fuller wants us to understand that in the American judicial climate, all of these are things that judges might do without getting fired and in fact do. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Fred. I guess we can turn now to Dan Priel. In Toronto, and ask what reflections he has about how the facts and the record get used here. What does the article tell us about how far judges should go and what they should know and what they should not know and what they should pretend they don't know?
Hi. Yes. Thank you very much. So I also, like Jim and Fred, think that this is a wonderful case, and I can, to the countries that in which this case is taught, I can add another one. I taught in the UK, and there too, this case is used as a teaching material in legal theory or jurisprudence classes. And actually, I want to build a bit on Fred's last comments to talk about the, if you want, the jurisprudential side of this case or this article. To me, what's interesting is that Fuller is taking on a position that in 1949 sort of anticipates debates that are big in jurisprudential circles these days, and he I would argue challenges two prominent or widely received views. So the first thing is that the question that he talks about in this paper, one of the issues that he talks about, is the question of what might be called the limits of law, where law ends and where other normative systems begin, the interaction between them. This is particularly common these days in debates about the relationship between law and morality. Now, Fuller takes on this question and challenges the debates that exist today in two ways. First of all, he shows that debating the question of the limits of law or the boundaries of law only against the perspective or against morality is a very limited way of looking at this. And as I will try to show, in each one of the judgments, you can see that he shows the question of the limits of law from a slightly different angle. He shows that there are other perspectives in which we can talk about the limits of law. And the second aspect in which he challenges many contemporary views, and because of which I think this paper or this article is still useful not just as a teaching tool but also for thinking about law, is that he challenges the claim or the view that's very popular that these boundaries between those questions about the limits of law are somehow conceptual, that they are true for all law in all times and places. As he shows, these are actually the question of the boundary of law is a question that is a political one or a normative one, and that therefore different political views may lead to different outcomes or different views on the question of limits. So how do these different views manifest themselves in the different judgments? So the first is Chief Justice Truepenny. So for him, it's very important to distinguish between the domain or the underlying value of law, which for him, I guess, is justice, or perhaps he would prefer to say justice according to law, and the value of mercy. So mercy is the domain of other officials, the governor or president, but the chief executive, but not of the judiciary. And therefore, for him, it's very clear that justice, according to law, requires conviction, even though mercy and overall morality perhaps require clemency. Then Justice Foster, in a part of his decision that was not discussed by Fred, makes a very interesting argument. It's one that in a way is a bit off the wall, but is very interesting. So he, in a way, says to us, we find the idea of geographical jurisdiction completely obvious. We find it completely completely normal, completely unremarkable, that once you move from the state of New York to the state of Connecticut, the laws that apply to you change. Once you move from the United States to Canada, the laws that apply to you change. And then he says, but what is the basis for this limit to the boundary of law? And he says, well, it must be something like a social contract. And then if we take this idea of social contract seriously, he says, then it also has a moral limit to the social contract. And these people, he says, were outside of that social contract. So here's another way of looking at the question of the limit of law, and that's why, he says, the laws of New Garth don't apply to these people. Then we move to Justice Tatting. And for him, he gets to the question of boundaries of law in a different way. He ultimately says, I don't find anything in the law that can decide this matter. That's why he withdraws. He simply says, I'm torn this way and that way, and in the end, the law just doesn't have an answer to this case. So for him, in the most strongest of terms, the law ends when he comes to this to answer this question. For Justice Keene, the distinction is between a moral dilemma and a legal question. So for him, it's very important that the two be kept separate, and he criticizes other justices for confusing this distinction. So for him, the boundary between what a judge has to do, which is decide according to law, is very different from deciding according to, from the moral dilemma that if you ask people on the street, how should these people be treated, these are two completely separate questions. And finally, Justice Handy, when he relies on information about public opinion, when he says, I've read in the newspaper that most of the public, 90% of the public, support exonerating these people, he seems to say something that for most of us is outside the boundaries of law. Law is the courts should not rely on public opinion. But here, actually, Fuller is anticipating something that would become bigger in the following decades. Starting in the late 50s, there have been a lot of empirical work, empirical studies showing that at least the United States Supreme Court never strays too far from mainstream public opinion. And this is true about desegregation, this is true about abortion. For those who would like to make predictions, this is perhaps true of same-sex marriage. And if that's indeed the case, and empirical evidence seems to say that this is indeed the case, then perhaps Handy is just more, as Fred said, just more open about this than others. So here again, we see the question of what is acceptable legal argument, the boundaries of what law and not law is, raised in a fifth way. So I think this, and to sum it up, that one of the really great features of this article is the diversity of ways in which the question of the boundary of law is raised.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. That has indeed given us an interesting perspective on each of the judges. We're going to return now to Jim Allen and ask him to, in one sense, pick up where he left off, but perhaps in a different sense, pick up where Dan and Fred left off, and talk about teaching this article and perhaps about some of its continuing relevance.
Well, thank you, Jim. I'll make three points and then throw it open to my colleagues. Again, this is a 16-page article, and there is so much packed into it. So we've all been focusing on the various approaches to interpretation, which is clearly the main theme of the article. But an underlying theme that's also there is this sense of what you might we in the non-American world would call institutional competence. You might call it separation of powers. The question that is which of the branches ought to be deciding this sort of thing? And as Fred points out, it's a very subtle argument, because even Keene, who's the justice who's the most clear-cut, even Keene says at one point that as a private citizen, you know, after blasting the Chief Justice for suggesting that the governor issue a pardon, Keene says, well, look, as a private citizen, I would, of course, pardon these guys. And that's a cheat, of course, because private citizens don't get their opinions published in opinions, judgments at public expense. So even Keene, who is wanting to keep the lines clear, even he sort of steps over the line when he says, I would pardon as a private citizen. And all this feeds into the sort of ancillary set of issues about institutional competence. What ought judges to be doing, or the elected branches? And Keene has quite an argument about why this is for the elected branches. Second thing I'd say is that when you do this case in the UK, and I've done it there too, I had William Twining teach me this, and he was great too. You have to remember that in 1949, when Fuller's writing this, there are two jurisdictions in the world, two democracies with the Bill of Rights. There's the U.S. and France. And the French Bill of Rights, which is older than the American one, was not justiciable. It only became justiciable a handful of years ago. And so it's not unfair to say that the last 66 years, you could describe that in a sentence as the triumph of American constitutionalism. So the idea of really powerful judges sitting there and making calls, this is totally foreign to the non-American world in 1949. And so what makes this case so powerful is that basically it imagines a world where what is important is having unelected judges making important calls. And the world has moved that way. Australia still has not moved that way, but the rest of the democratic world has moved that way. In 1949, this case was a very U.S.-centric view of the world. And as Twining always would say to us, if you're a feminist, if you're a Marxist, if you're looking at jurisprudence through the eyes of a non-American in 1949, the case doesn't do much for you. Today, it does a lot for you around the democratic world. So he got that right, or he guessed right, or the events has moved his way. And I guess the last thing I would say about this article is, if you're a legal academic, and you're looking for immortality, having people read your stuff in 50 years is about as close as you're going to get. You know, there are a handful of people who might make a century. Well, this case is going to make a century. It's been 66 years. You know, you can start ticking them off. Hart will make immortality on that line. Fuller will. People still read Bentham, Holmes. I'm not sure Dworkin will make it. Maybe, maybe not. I'm not so sure myself. So this is an astounding accomplishment to have people on a regular basis today reading something you've written. It's just amazing. I suppose that I'll just hand over now back to Fred to say a few things.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that the time period. It's also important to remember that 1949 was 1 year after Nuremberg. And one of the big issues at Nuremberg was here we have a group of defendants that did a range of things that were clearly well beyond the moral pale, but the argument was out there that however immoral the Nuremberg defendants behaved, they did not violate any particular item of positive law. This gets into questions about natural law, about international law, and so on. But one of the issues that was out there in 1948 at Nuremberg time was, again, this issue, what happens if we have people who behaved immorally but may not have violated the positive law? This is the mirror image. What happens when people have violated the positive law but may not have acted immorally? One other little thing that I'll mention, picking up on what Dan was talking about the boundaries of law. Yes, Justice Handy talks about public opinion. He talks about the side knowledge that he gets from his wife's hairdresser or housekeeper. I don't remember which it was. this in the era of the internet is now a very big issue. Judge Posner has frequently said, non-bashfully, yes, if I need to know something when I am trying to decide a case as a judge of the Seventh Circuit and the oral argument and briefs and record below don't give me the information that I need, I will go out there with the assistance of my clerks and do my own independent research on the internet to find out what I need to know. The fact that it's not in the record, the fact that it's not in the briefs, the fact that it's not in oral argument is not particularly troubling. He wants to go out and find out what he needs to know. Similarly, in a large number of cases, perhaps most prominently the school integration, desegregation, affirmative action case from Seattle and Louisville a few years ago, parents involved, Justice Breyer again did a vast amount of research about the history of school assignment, the history of integration and segregation, especially in Seattle. None of it in the briefs. Justice Breyer has done similar things on other occasions, and Justice Handy anticipates that a big issue in the future, and it is a big issue now, is to what extent should judges, especially with modern information technology, be free to go well beyond the four corners of the briefs and the record to find out what they think they need to know.
Well, an interesting question, assuming that judges do, this Jim Haynes, that assuming that judges do expand their research beyond what was the norm 50 years ago, is what do you do with what you know if what you know conflicts with what's in the briefs, or if it leads you to a conclusion that is not necessarily justified in the record you get from the clerk's office? Does Fuller shed any light on how to? We know what Justice Handy would do. He would use that as the reason to reach his decision to reverse the conviction below. But does Justice Fuller, Professor Fuller, shed any real light on this question beyond just identifying it?
Not here, but maybe he does in his other writings. And his other writings, in some sense, might be representative of two different positions. The Fuller of a important and enduring book called The Morality of Law, the Fuller who engaged in an important 1958 debate on the pages of the Harvard Law Review with his Oxford counterpart, H.L.A. Hart, is someone who was comfortable with judges using common sense, their own perceptions of reasonableness, in order to make what they thought was the right decision. On the other hand, the Fuller, who towards the end of his life published a number of works under the general heading, The Forms and Limits of Adjudication, was very sensitive to what judges were good at and what judges were not good at, and called for a science of trying to figure out which things, which decisions, which policy questions should be assigned to judges and which should be assigned to various other bodies that might be better at making these kinds of decisions. So just as in the Spelunky and Explorers, Fuller might have been a little two-faced in the best sense of the word or phrase about this. He recognized the inevitability and maybe the desirability, although that's controversial, of judges using their own private or non-official understanding of facts, morality, and lots of other things, but he also recognized that there were things that other institutions were better at than courts, including some forms of information identification, some forms of getting the facts, getting the information that they need to know.
Well, that the gist, at least in part of what you have said, is that Fuller learned as he grew older, and his position apparently changed a little bit on that. I would like to inquire of Dan Priel. In your remarks, you talked about, to some degree, the distinction that the different systems and perceptions of a society might influence where the lines fall and what judges do and what they shouldn't. And that has been a theme through all of our panelists. But while your remarks kind of talked about the transitory and changeable nature of these boundaries, Professor Fuller, at the end of his article, writes a rather portentous postscript in which he reveals why he talks about the Supreme Court of Newgarth in the year 4300. And he sort of attempts to link together the imaginary realm of Newgarth, Harvard in 1949, but then he reaches back to the Athens of Plato, Aristotle, and Pericles. And he says rather clearly that he thinks that these questions and this article are really about enduring things. That the core of his article is something that would have and did puzzle the thinkers and philosophers of ancient Athens, and that they did and they do and will sort of puzzle the thinkers, philosophers, and judges in the year 4300 if we make it that far. So to ask a brief question at the end of a long sort of prologue, Dan, is this a permanent sort of statement about what Lon Fuller was trying to do, and how does that relate to the different kind of line drawing that you were talking about?
So I think to some extent Fuller's own personality is reflected in this paper, and one of the points that I think Jim mentioned in the beginning in his comments was that Fuller gives fair hearing to all views, which is quite remarkable. But I think it also is reflective of his own personality. One thing that sometimes people find difficult or even frustrating about reading his work is that he seems to he lacks the kind of orderliness and rigor that people sometimes expect from philosophy, which is why some people actually don't think very highly of him, I think wrongly, but there are people who think that he's too disorganized and his ideas go in all kinds of directions without a clear theme. So I think in part perhaps he found this genre one that he could flourish in, or one that he enjoyed so much. He did it more than once. This is not the only invented case that he wrote, exactly because it allowed him to try to bring the best of different views. And in part, and that is something that as one grows older, one sees is that in these sorts of domains, in the domains of politics, it's very, very difficult to come up with the knockdown argument that will leave others on the other side speechless and saying, you know what, you just won the argument. And so in this respect, it is, I think, correct. Fuller is correct to say that the kinds of questions and the kind of argumentative moves that we see in this article are not novel. As Fred said, perhaps with one or two exceptions, I still think that it would be unusual for a judge today and in 1949 to mention explicitly relying on private information. But with the exception of this, as Fred said, almost everything in this is not does not strike a contemporary reader as crazy, as something that we wouldn't expect judges to say. There are, in fact, some passages that I read and I thought, that's pretty much what Justice Scalia says in some of his judicial or extrajudicial writings, things like this. So in one respect, as I said, there is Fuller, the scholar, who himself is one that is impressed by arguments coming from different directions, and I think that's why he used this. He enjoyed this genre of writing. That's one sort of personal aspect of it, and the other is the political aspect, which is the fact that it's these sort of political legal arguments are, as he says, I think, eternal.
Well, we'll get Jim Allen here.
Yeah, I was just going to cut in because I hadn't really thought of it. I just want to cut in on Dan's point about the format or the genre of writing. And it is very hard to do, but if you do it properly, it can be astoundingly effective. I'm thinking, as Dan was talking, I was thinking about, my favorite philosopher is probably David Hume. He's got to be in anyone's top five. And one of his maybe his greatest masterpiece, certainly one of them, was his Dialogues on Natural Religion. It's a piece about the argument from design, about the existence of God, and it's all done in the dialogue format, which is essentially what Fuller's doing here. He's using judges and judgments, but it's a dialogue between different points of view. And normally that's really hard to do, which is why when you're looking for examples of it being done really well, you've got Fuller, you've got Hume, you go back to Plato, I suppose, and that's about it. But Fuller really has done a great job with this format, and it's true that you don't see it too often, which is maybe why there's only one Harvard Law Review with no footnotes article, but he does it really well here, and he puts himself up there in that class of using the genre exceptionally well. At least I think so.
Very good. I was going to ask you, Professor Allen, do you think that the reference in the postscript to Athens and all of the rest of that is that a little portentous and a little dated at this stage? Do your students show up with cloaks and laurel wreaths and sandals because they think of Pericles when they're studying this article, or is that kind of a period thing that has not aged perhaps as well as the rest of the article?
Be totally honest, Jim, even though we get the best students in Queensland, I'd be happy if half of the students who showed up in my class even knew who Pericles was, even Athens, really. So I think in 1949, the cultural assumptions of the kids coming into class would have been a heck of a lot different than what we're getting now. I don't know what it's like in the States, but the kind of references you could make, like something like a Damascene conversion or a Good Samaritan, half my students would have no clue what you're talking about, and these are smart kids. So that sort of thing might be a lot harder to do. Was it a bit over the top? I hadn't really noticed that before. I'd be interested to know how that played out in the States. I don't really know.
Well, I was going to let Fred close us out here because he is the one who actually took a class from Professor Fuller, and I was going to ask if there were any sort of reminiscences that you wanted to share about the author of this article when he was teaching.
This was towards the end of his life and career. I'm not sure the class was Fuller at his best. Much of the world of jurisprudence at the time was dominated by debates between positivism and natural law, or dominated by the debates between Hart and Fuller, and to some extent the U.S.-based but Austrian Hans Kelsen. Fuller at the time probably felt that he was treated less well by the jurisprudential community than he deserved. I think perhaps all of us in this conversation may think the same thing. Fuller was not particularly, his comparative advantage was not as an analytic philosopher. His comparative advantage was probably in his more qualitative, less analytic understanding and sense of just how especially the American legal system operated. It may be important to at least for some of us, to try to recognize Fuller's sociological, in the best sense of the word, perceptiveness, even while recognizing that sharp analytic distinctions were not what he was best at. That's true as we read him now, and that was true in 1969.
Well, thank you very much. I think maybe we can check and see if Dean has any questions waiting, and so I will turn the call over to him at this time. I guess I should ask if any of the panelists have any final thoughts or reactions before we do that. But otherwise, we'll give it to Dean and the questions.
Terrific. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're in the audience, you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see, Jim, if anybody rings in, let me make just a brief commercial announcement. Tomorrow, an in-person program here in Washington, D.C., our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference at the Mayflower Hotel from 9 to 3:30, a day-long conference looking at the administrative branch. It's not quite a branch unto itself, but it almost is. It's a free conference, no cost to attend. That's tomorrow at the Mayflower Hotel. Also tomorrow, the Supreme Court will be issuing opinions, so do check your inbox in the Federal Society website for teleform conference calls that might be scheduled for tomorrow afternoon. And Friday, in terms of teleforms, we have a call on securities markets and market regulations at noon on Friday. Today, of course, we're talking about the Law Classic, the Classic Law Review article. And if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Jim, it looks like our audience is, here we have one question at last. So let's take this first question.
It's David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. It was a fascinating discussion, and I hope we see more of these, Dean. The question I have has to do with, much of the discussion has to do with the moral side here as opposed to the positive letter of the law. And my question to the participants has been more along, how are we doing in the law schools in inculcating different schools of moral philosophy, moral thought in our students? Kantian, authoritarian, utilitarianism. These are the types of tools that the judges will need at some point as a resource to draw upon in dealing with these types of questions.
I mean, I think... Fred Schauer here. I think most, at least I won't say most, the American law schools I know best, and I have taught full-time or as a visitor at a number of them, do deal with a range of these questions, although perhaps without the names and without the labels that you mention. It is certainly the case that given the increase in the importance of law and economics in American law schools, at least, students will be familiar with utilitarian and consequentialist reasoning. Given the presence of other courses or other people who will challenge law and economics paradigms, there will be certainly plenty of exposure to whether we want to call it Kantian or Rawlsian or deontological or some other label for non-consequentialist, non-utilitarian reasoning will also be part of the discussions in law schools. There isn't very much that would address these issues exactly as they would be addressed in a philosophy course, but I can't imagine that a student would come out of a constitutional law course or a tort course or a criminal law course without being somewhat familiar with these basic debates and with the basic positions.
Anybody else have a comment on that question?
This is Dan here. I would say that the same is true, at least as far far as I know, well, at least with regard to my course, I teach fairly regularly tort law for first semester, first year students, and at least my students get to hear about and even with the isms. So they get to hear about consequentialist theories or approaches to tort law or utilitarian approaches to tort law versus more rights based approaches. So it's definitely not at the depth of what I would imagine you'd get to in a graduate school or if you take a graduate degree in the philosophy department, but some exposure to the ideas is there, and I'm sure that I'm not the only one who does that. So there is I think some discussion of these different approaches to moral questions.
And Jim Allen, what would justice?
Yeah.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Go ahead.
No, go ahead,
Fred.
Jim, go ahead.
I was going to ask Jim Allen just to kind of round this out. What two questions? What would Justice Handy say about all of this philosophizing and all of the different schools of constitutional law and tort law? And would it matter to him? And the easy answer would be no, perhaps, but the somewhat more complex answer. And then the other question would be, what are students asking for in terms of trying to understand law? And all of you who teach, now we can turn this around and make it a little bit more accessible. We know now what is being instructed on the demand side. What are students coming in and looking for? So Justice Handy, and then what are students looking for?
Well, thanks, Jim. I guess the Handy question is tied into the points that Fred and Dan have made. I agree with them, but I guess I'm a slightly more skeptical. I think I agree with the sort of line that Jeremy Waldron runs, which is that you can be a really good judge, and in fact, almost all judges are really good, without being an expert on Kant or Hume or Bentham or whatever. And in fact, most top judges really don't know all that much moral philosophy. If you put them in a room with professional philosophers, they'd be embarrassed. And Waldron goes on to show in the U.S. context, but also the U.K. one, that even the big ticket judgments, the opinions that are really high profile, the amount of actual moral philosophy going on is you can put in the thumbnail. And I tend to be sympathetic to that. So I mean, I accept that we want judges who are familiar with the positions, but they don't need to be able to cite Kant. And when they do cite him, they usually cite him out of context because one of their students has dug it up from somewhere. So I don't think we need that, and I don't think Fuller would have liked that all that much either. I might be wrong about what Fuller thought, but so.
Well, Fred will straighten that out.
Yeah. To the extent that ties into Handy, the question is, I take it your question was, you know, how attractive is Handy? We're trying to avoid today, I think, all three of us picking which of the positions we would favor ourselves, because as Fred said, they're all defensible. Some are less attractive to me than others. When I poll my students, you know, you poll them before you start. I poll them before I start talking about the case, and you get a pretty even split between the three. It varies year to year, but there's never any one of the three judges who doesn't get 10 or 15%. I assume we'll put aside tatting as a, it's a rhetorical device. You need to have the case end up split 2-2. So no one's going to vote to be with tatting, I don't think. And it varies, but even, and some people change their minds after we've talked about the case, they move. But Handy's, I think he's acceptable, and I think the students, what are they looking for when they do a jurisprudence course? Well, in the universities I've taught in, it's always been a compulsory course. That's not too frequent. It's frequent, and you know, it does exist in a few universities in Australia, the UK, New Zealand. These are law students who must take jurisprudence along with contracts. It's a compulsory course. So many of them don't want to be there. They do not see the value. And I would say that at least half of them afterwards are glad they took the course. You know, they're happy. Now, I don't do a course that goes into sort of minor sub-branch. I just run through the what I think is the best writing in jurisprudence in the last 50 or 100 years. And this is always one of the things I make them read.
Jim, this is Dean Breaker.
Go ahead.
We've got about 5 minutes left. We've got one other question pending. Do you want to continue this discussion or take another question?
Well, let's take the question.
All right. Stand by.
This is Jack Park. Thank you all very much. I guess Jim Allen kind of took this in his last comments. I went to law school 35 years ago or so, and there was not really expressed jurisprudence that I remember, but it was inferential. Should the law schools more generally approach jurisprudence expressly, or should they do it as Dan suggested? You get it as part of your what you're doing in torts.
I mean, part of Fred Schauer here. Part of the problem is that, like it or not, students resist required courses. They sort of understand that contracts and torts and property and criminal law and civil procedure and maybe a few others are going to be required, but add anything else and make it required, and that will build in a little bit of ex ante resistance. That's an issue that all of us have to deal with. I typically get 75 or 80 students in an entirely elective jurisprudence course. I think one of the reasons is that I spend some of the time in the course on enduring conceptual issues about legal philosophy, but a fair amount of time on theoretical, call it philosophical as well, study of actual legal reasoning and legal argument. And I think the students appreciate a theoretical look at issues of rules and precedent and authority and things of this variety. And Fuller's work works very well for that. If we think of this not as an entry into the enduring conflicts between positivism and natural law, but rather as an engaging way to talk about legal reasoning, to talk about a persistent issue in actual law practice where the best policy arguments, the best moral arguments, the best pragmatic arguments may go in one direction and the law may go in another. Students tend to understand that this is important, and they, even if not required to do it, are inclined to want to do it. Indeed, it's conceivable that one of the opinions that the U.S. Supreme Court will issue tomorrow is an opinion regarding their interpretation of the healthcare statute, in which at least one of the arguments out there is, what if the exact letter of a small number of words goes in one direction, but the large spirit of the entire statutory scheme goes in the other direction? What are judges to do? I'm not going to answer that question here, but anybody reading Fuller's Spelunky and Explorers ought to recognize that it has a lot to say to that very question.
Are there any other reactions to the question that that we just had?
It's Dan here. So I actually had jurisprudence as a compulsory course, and maybe I'm not the most representative of students because I ended up an academic. But I'm quite happy that I had this course, and I think that there is a way of having or creating a course like this that could be engaging to students, even if you bear in mind that maybe one, at most one of your students is going to remain or to study, to continue as an academic. My perspective, or my, the way that I try to do it in my jurisprudence class, and I think in this respect it's much more of a Fullerian approach to this subject than the more conceptual debates that are found in some courses, is I say to my students, look, in tort law, you look at one branch of law, and in criminal law, you look at one branch of law, and in contract law, and so on. This is the one course where you'll have the bird's eye view, and there are things that you can only see from afar. And so it's this perspective, the bird's eye view of the law, that I think you miss in most courses that are specific. So even though I do mention utilitarianism versus rights-based theories in tort law, it's still discussed in the tort law course in the context of particular tort law questions. And that's not, that doesn't address the kind of issues that I think a separate jurisprudence course can deal with, which is exactly the way that these different areas of law can interact with each other, or can, so what are the circumstances under which we will use public law versus private law, contract law versus tort law, and so on. That's the perspective that I think you won't get, even in a theoretically informed tort law course, say.
Dan, this is Jim Allen here. I'm not sure I'm disagreeing with you, but I think a good jurisprudence course isn't aimed at the one kid who's going to go on and be a law professor. I think it's aimed at the kids who are going to go out and be really good lawyers. And I don't want to suggest to the Federalist Society the next article they ought to look at, but in Oliver Wendell Holmes' The Path of the Law at the end, he talks about the value of jurisprudence. He's flogging it not to would-be law professors. He's flogging it to people who go out and are going to be, you know, the great lawyers, the big-picture lawyers. And so I think the course works best for the students who are going to go out and be, you know, top-notch lawyers. They need to have these big-picture issues in their heads. And that's why I see the value not just of this article, which is tremendous, but of the kind of course that I heard Fred describing.
Yeah, no. If I wasn't clear, that's exactly what I aim my course at. I'm not aiming it at the future law professor. And as it happens, The Path of the Law is also on my reading list as one of those classics.
Yeah,
that,
another great one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's see if we have any other questions, and if not, maybe we'll go around the panel for one final set of reactions to this article and call it an afternoon. Dean, do we have anybody else?
No questions pending at this point, Jim.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to – something that came up during the discussion very briefly was a kind of a theme here about withdrawing individuals who try to get out of the process. And I noticed that the unfortunate Mr. Wetmore, who first suggests that they roll the dice in order to find out which of them will be killed and eaten, attempts to withdraw, and then he is killed and eaten. And Justice Tatting withdraws, but his attempted withdrawal simply causes the death sentence to be carried out, as far as the article is concerned. I'm not sure that Fuller made a big thing out of it, but does anybody see a theme there about the unintended consequences of the suggestions that people make and the actions that they try to make?
I mean, I suppose, as I said before, if we think of this as an article written a year after Nuremberg and 4 years after the end of the Second World War, perhaps, and only perhaps, Fuller was trying to say something about the impossibility of withdrawing under certain circumstances.
I have a different suggestion about why this is there. I'm not sure. It's a speculation just like Fred's. But there is a section in the Article 4, the French code, Civil Code, reads as follows. A judge who refuses to give judgment on the pretext of legislation being silent, obscure, or insufficient may be prosecuted for being guilty of a denial of justice. So I don't know if Fuller had this in mind when he put this padding withdrawing in there, but it is well known that Fuller was very knowledgeable in European law and in European jurisprudence. He cites in his writings many legal theorists from Europe that are nowadays, at least to most English speakers, as far as I know, completely obscure, and he cites them in the original languages of French and German. So I would not be surprised if he was familiar with this section of the French Civil Code, and maybe thought of using Tatting's withdrawal as a launching pad for discussing this section of the French Civil Code.
Very interesting. Any other comments?
Jim Allen here. I guess I would just say on the Wetmore withdrawal, I mean, it allows you to talk briefly with the students about a bit of game theory, because the other four people in the cave, if they let Wetmore withdraw and they proceed to roll the dice, it becomes pretty clear when the students start thinking about it that the hardline students, I say, well, what happens after they've killed the other one? Are they going to let Wetmore eat? And you know, the hardline students want to say no because he withdrew. But of course, they're going to have to let him have food once the person's dead and there's enough for them all to last. And so in game theory terms, to try to withdraw from rolling the dice is a 100% guarantee that you'll live. And so they can't allow that to happen. And you can get off on a tangent on that. So I don't know if this was a Fuller intention, but it does allow you to think about, once you've decided to go down this route, do you have to compel everyone to be part of the rolling the dice thing? And the answer might well be yes.
Well, I think we will all keep that in mind in our cave explorations, exactly how to handle the problems that arise in this sort of thing, and perhaps we can wrap this up and give it back to Dean. And I certainly want to express my thanks to each of the panelists, and hope that we could do this again sometime.
Thank you.
This is Dean Royer. Let me add my thanks to our three panelists, but also to Jim Haynes, who organized and then moderated this discussion. So thank you all. I certainly appreciate this very, very interesting discussion. To the audience, thank you as well for joining us. And a reminder that we might likely have a teleforum conference call tomorrow. Certainly have one scheduled for Friday, but do check our website for updates. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.